break away. I scrambled backward through the mud, heels digging into the ground, the broken rib a hot fist of agony in my side.
Wait! I gasped. Stop! Why are you...
Lyle leaped at me. He landed with all of his weight on my right knee. I didn't hear a crack that time, but pain exploded through my leg. I yelped as Lyle wrestled me to the ground again.
Shut up!
He roared. He struck me across the face with so much force my head snapped to the side. His claws raked through my cheek, and something in my jaw cracked. His face was only inches from mine, his breath hot on my skin, and his hand slipped from my face to my neck. His long fingers and claws closed around my throat, right over the bruises already there, the ones that never healed. And through the throbbing pain, I smelled green grass and spilled beer, and I saw my own face in the slick curve of a car windshield and a reflection behind me, and I couldn't breathe, I couldn't breathe, I couldn't breathe! The pressure on my neck vanished. My ears were ringing. But it wasn't until I saw Lyle's wide eyes did I realize I had been screaming. There was a flash of something on his face. Pity, almost. But he quickly stamped it down.
You can't get away.
His voice was ragged and oddly high. He couldn't be much older than me.
I can't let you get away. I'm sorry.
I wasn't much persuaded by his apology. I kept fighting, beating and scratching at his arms and face. But it was no use. No matter how much damage I did to him, he had broken my rib and my leg and probably my jaw, and I wasn't healing fast enough. He lifted me easily, swung me over his shoulder. The motion sent a fresh wave of pain through every part of my body. I felt the cracked rib shifting as his shoulder dug into my abdomen, and his arm hooked around my legs made my knee hurt so much my vision blurred. Lyle carried me to the fence and jumped the ditch. That hurt too, but groaning in protest only made it worse. He walked me up the road, up the driveway, past the church and the playground. Violet was nowhere to be seen, but the woman and children were still there, watching me like spectators at a funeral procession. Lyle stopped, shoes scuffing in the dirt, and Mr. Willow said,
I'm proud of you, Lyle.
I couldn't see him, slung as I was over Lyle's shoulder. Trying to lift my head for a better view only made my jaw feel like somebody was ripping it away with their hands.
I know you must have been tempted to let her go, said Mr. Willow.
He sounded so understanding, so gentle. He wasn't angry. He wasn't blaming anybody. Lyle said nothing.
You have a good heart, Mr. Willow went on, and I know you don't wish to do anybody harm. You only want to help.
I only want to help Esme,
Lyle said, sullen, like a child tired of having to explain himself.
I know. But you understand, Mother does not see these things as we do. It would be dangerous for you to ask a boon of her without bringing a gift.
He said Mother like a title, an honorific, solemn rather than familiar. Footsteps on gravel, and Mr. Willow came around Lyle's side to look at me. He grabbed my hair to lift my head.
She will like this one. Take it inside.
In the front room of the yellow house, Violet was holding Esme and rocking her, murmuring reassurances. Esme's eyes were squeezed shut, but they snapped open as Lyle passed the doorway.
You have to hide,
Esme said, her voice so clear and so strong it made Lyle jump.
Lyle, Lyle, you have to hide! You have to hide! They're coming! You have to hide!
Violet will see to your sister,
Mr. Willow said as Lyle paused in the hallway.
You have to hide! You have to hide!
Esme pushed Violet's hands away and shook her head.
You have to hide! I'll stop them! Lyle! Lyle! You have to hide!
Into the kitchen, please, and wait for me.
There was a trace of impatience in Mr. Willow's voice.
The floor is easier to clean in there.
Lyle kicked one of the chairs away from the kitchen table and sat me in it. I tried to stand and lurch away, but my leg gave out from under me with an agonizing pop. Lyle lifted me again, and this time he used both hands to hold me in place, one on my shoulder, the other curling around my neck.
"Move and I'll rip your throat out," he said.
Then, softer, close to my ear,
"I'm sorry. Don't move. I'm sorry."
I didn't try to answer. My jaw was swollen and hot, my entire face burning with pain. I heard a soft drip, drip, drip. I was bleeding on their white tile floor. I hoped it stained the grout so deeply no bleach could ever get it out. In the other room, Esme was still talking.
"You have to hide. Lyle, you have to hide."
Mr. Willow returned to the kitchen. He was on the phone.
"Of course, of course. We all have our doubts, but we must remain strong. I know you can remain strong. Give my love to Barbara, and my apologies for dragging you away from her again."
A pause, a warm chuckle.
"You're lucky to have her. We'll be there by 6, if the road construction isn't too bad. Is the other one secure? Good, good. It will be good to see you, Brian. I know Lila's looking forward to learning from you. He is eager to do his part. Take care."
He set the phone down and turned to me.
"I don't like to do this," he said, "but you leave me no choice. It would have been easier if you had chosen this willingly."
He came a few steps closer. I kicked him with my good leg, splattered mud all over his khakis. He frowned and stepped back again. He wore the expression of somebody disappointed by a badly behaved puppy. The peculiar little beetle of shadow he carried deep in his chest began to unfurl, but I couldn't reach him. I had grabbed the wrong man. I could have avoided all of this pain if only I had touched Mr. Willow's hand and killed him.
"I spoke to Danny earlier, while you were with Violet,"
said Mr. Willow casually, as though sharing news about a mutual friend.
"He said he's never seen anything like you before. He has found so many different creatures for us, but you're new. He was quite repulsed."
Danny, who had been staring at me like I was a puzzle to be solved, seeing something in me nobody else saw. The understanding was like needles under my skin. He had never wanted to help. I spat a wad of mud and blood onto the floor. Lyle's claws pressed into my shoulder.
"But we know what you are. You are a foul, lying thing that masquerades as human."
Mr. Willow opened a cupboard and took out a few metal containers, the kind tea comes in, but old, dented, the labels long ago worn away. In another cupboard he found a glass, filled it with water, and set it on the counter.
"Sometimes you do it very well. Well enough to fool even yourself. But your true nature will always be revealed in the end."
He spooned a scoop from each tin into the water. Metal clinked on glass as he stirred. A moldy, earthy scent filled the kitchen. He opened another cabinet and brought out a jar with a metal lid. It wasn't until he unscrewed the lid and carefully tipped the jar did I see what it contained. Beetles, each about the size of his thumbnail, scurrying and crawling over each other. Mr. Willow nudged a couple into the glass.
"The world is full of things like you," he said. "Most people refuse to see, but a few of us know better."
With the backside of the spoon, he crushed the beetles. Each collapsed with a quick, wet snap.
"It's not an easy thing to know about the world. Knowing also means carrying the burden of protecting the world from its worst creatures. Open its mouth, Lyle."
I clamped my jaw shut. The pain made spots dance in my eyes. But Lyle was already digging his fingers into my gums and pressing down on my tongue. I thrashed at him with my free arm, scraping at his face, at his hands. But he hunched behind me and wrapped an arm around my chest to hold me in place.
It used to be that when terrible things came into a community, we knew how to destroy them. The abominations. The evil creatures. Things like you.
Mr. Willow tapped the spoon on the side of the glass and set it aside. He didn't look as calm as he sounded. He was still afraid of me.
Now, if there are monsters that wear human faces living in our cities, or hunting through our schools, or inviting darkness into our homes with whispers in the night, we have no defenses.
Lyle's claws dug into my chin and my tongue as he pried my mouth open. I tasted blood, felt it pooling under my tongue. I tried to throw my head from side to side, tried to spit, bite, flail, but Lyle was too strong. In one smooth motion, Mr. Willow tipped the glass into my throat. Lyle forced my mouth closed before I could spit it out. My teeth ground together. The concoction had the texture of muddy leaves and dirt, but it tasted of rotten meat left in the sun, rancid and green, with a tangy bitterness. Sharp edges scraped my throat and tongue. I gagged, but Lyle pressed his big hand over my mouth, and I couldn't spit it out. Mr. Willow stepped back. I felt his shadow unfolding long and thin, a filthy smudge spreading through the white kitchen.
No defenses except for us, he said, and Mother, who is our salvation and our strength. There is too much evil in the world for us to fight at all, but with her help we do what we can. We will help you. You can't go on like this, this terrible, monstrous thing. She will be so happy to see you.
I wanted to tell him I didn't want to meet his mother. I might be a monstrous creature now. I might be unnatural. I might even be evil. But I didn't want his help. But I couldn't say a thing. My tongue grew numb, and the numbness spread, dampening my anger, cooling the throbbing pain of my damaged bones, a heavy blanket of relief creeping through my entire body as a cold, dense fog. My heart slowed, then stopped. The room darkened. The stars began to emerge.
Chapter 15. The universe is mostly empty space. The ground beneath our feet and the moon in the sky, the sun in the day and the stars at night, the feeling of being surrounded, embraced by matter and light and weight and heat, that's all misleading. That's the comforting lie we tell ourselves to avoid thinking about the truth, because the truth is darkness and emptiness and deep, deep cold. A woman named Karen Garrow told me that. Karen was my mother's closest friend. She was a physicist, and Mom was in neuroscience, but they worked together to study how people perceive space and time, how our minds comprehend things so much bigger and weirder than our everyday experience. Karen was tall and dark-haired, with copper skin and gray eyes. My sister Sunny told her once she looked like Nefertiti, and Karen had laughed and said she had her father to thank for that, whoever he was. Karen was always being invited to appear on television shows about physics and astronomy. She was the one they interviewed when they wanted to prove that science was for minorities and young women as much as old white men. Every time she was on the Science Channel, I recorded the episodes and kept them on the DVR. I watched them all more than once and told myself it was because she was Mom's friend and I found the topics interesting. The summer after my freshman year of high school, Karen came with us to the lake cottage for a few weeks. She and Mom were writing a paper. They worked every day on the covered porch, articles and laptops spread before them, lemonade sweating in glasses, lunch forgotten on plates. And every day I tucked myself into a wicker deck chair with a book from my summer reading list. I pretended to read while I watched Karen work. She wore glasses when she was writing. Heavy black frames in the best sexy librarian style. They slipped down her nose every couple of minutes. She pushed them up without thinking. One afternoon, after lunch, my sister Meadow shouted for Mom inside the house, and Mom went to help her find her bathing suit, her sunscreen, her hat, whatever she was looking for. Meadow never kept track of anything. The screen door snapped shut, and Karen tilted her chair back on two legs, stretched her arms above her head.
"Your mother is a slave driver, Breezy," she said. "Do you think she'd let me take the afternoon off to go to the beach?"
"She might," I said. I had been watching them, and I knew Mom was the one who was restless. Karen, the one so lost in her notes, she was surprised every time she looked up to see the sunlight had crept a little farther along the painted floor.
"She'll just have to deal with it," Karen said.
She pulled her long dark hair out of its ponytail, ran her fingers over her scalp, twisted her hair up again. There were faint lines along the back of her neck. Wrinkles, I thought. But when Karen rolled her head from side to side, I knew they were scars. "What are you working on?" I asked. She opened her eyes.
"Nothing."
Now that I had spotted the scars, I couldn't take my eyes off them. "Really?"
"Really.
Literally nothing." Karen leaned forward and rested her elbows on the scattered papers, tapped a pen with one hand. "Have you ever heard of the supervoids?" I wanted to say yes and impress her with my knowledge, but I had no idea what she was talking about. "I don't think so."
"Super what?"
"Voids," Karen said. She straightened her shoulders and lifted her chin, shifting effortlessly into the chatty professor persona she wore when she went on television to talk about black holes and parallel universes. "Voids in space. Regions where there are no stars, no galaxies, hardly any matter at all. There's simply nothing." I felt like she wanted me to be more impressed than I was.
"How big?"
"The Boötes void is 250 million light-years across, and it's nearly empty. Can you imagine that?" Karen was facing me now, gesturing with her hands. I couldn't see the scars on her neck anymore.
"It's crazy," I said.
"No, no, not so fast." Karen's ponytail swung back and forth as she shook her head. "Think about it before you answer. If our corner of the universe was as empty as that, we wouldn't have even known there were stars besides the sun until we had the telescopes we built in the 1960s. That's how far away the nearest stars would be. But would we have ever built telescopes at all if we didn't know there was anything out there worth looking for?"
"Can you imagine?"
Her eyes were wide and bright.
Try to imagine what that would be like."
I bit down on my initial response and did as she asked. I thought before I answered. There on the sun porch of our lake house, the summer day warm and blinding, I felt the hard wicker chair through the cushion beneath me, under my arm where I leaned. I smelled the dusty pages of my father's copy of Frankenstein and felt the soft old paper against my fingers. Through the screened windows I saw sunlight on water and sand, the wind turning through the tall grass. I heard Sunny giggling in that excited way she had when she forgot she was trying to be more grown up, and in the house Mom and Meadow were arguing, but not angrily. Their voices rose and fell as the floorboards creaked. A door slammed, and Meadow ran by the porch, a wide hat on her head and a bag over her shoulder. She slowed to a walk when she reached the sandy trail to the beach. Karen was watching me through her black-rimmed glasses. I closed my eyes and tried to put myself in outer space, tried to push away our blue and green earth surrounded by its artificial constellation of metal and mirrors, push away Mars, ruddy and cold, Jupiter with its angry spot, Saturn, black and white and wrapped in rings like it was in the Cassini photographs, beautiful blue Neptune with its captured moon Triton, our entire solar system in concentric ellipses around one lonely star. And farther out, the Horsehead Nebula in all its bright, false color, the pale blur of the Andromeda Galaxy, the clean curl of a black hole devouring its sister star. I pushed it all away, deleted the stars one by one, wiped clear the smear of the Milky Way and emptied the sky. I opened my eyes. No, I said. I can't imagine that.
Exactly,
said Karen, grinning in triumph. I saw what she must be like as a professor, tall and captivating before rows of awed students in a windowless lecture hall. Our brains aren't designed to handle that much emptiness. But it's real. It's the nature of our universe, whether or not we can comprehend it. The universe doesn't care if our tiny human brains understand anything. What do you know about quantum mechanics?
Schrödinger's cat, the one in the box. It's both dead and alive.
Karen laughed. A grossly inaccurate oversimplification of the concept, but I guess that's okay for a layperson. How about multiple universes? Entanglement? Quantum tunneling? Mom opened the screen door.
Really, Karen, I don't think you need to give my daughter an advanced physics lecture today. She's not your postdoc. She's on vacation.
I'm only trying to instill a sense of wonder in your depressingly sensible kid, Karen said. The word stung. I didn't want to be a kid, a layperson, a sensible child with no sense of wonder. I wanted to be more impressive than Karen's students. I wanted to dazzle her with my insightful questions and surprising knowledge. But she was already going back to work. I unfolded my legs from the old wicker chair and dog-eared my page in Frankenstein.
I don't mind, I said, but I'm going to go have a sense of wonder at the beach now.
Mom kissed my forehead.
Don't forget your sunscreen.
I changed into my swimsuit and headed down to the water. Meadow was lying on her stomach on a plaid blanket, head pillowed on her arms. She didn't stir when I sat down beside her, but a few minutes later she said,
If you can get over your girl crush on Karen long enough to notice, that guy with the kite is totally checking you out.
He is not, I said. Then, I don't have a crush.
Meadow didn't even look at me.
Yeah, right.
I don't, I thought. I like boys, I thought. It's not like that.
I worked down the list of possible responses in my mind. All of them sounded unconvincingly defensive.
So what if I do? I said.
Meadow's voice was sleepy and slow.
So what if you what?
Like girls too, as well as boys.
Both. Meadow groaned and threw her arm over her face.
Oh my God, I don't care. Go tell the kite boy if you want to share. Maybe he's into it. Guys think bi girls are hot.
I glared, but her eyes were closed, so I grabbed a handful of sand and threw it at her. I scrambled to my feet and skipped away before she could get me back. On this planet, at least, in this universe, there was only one star in the sky and not a cloud in sight. I caught the kite boy's eye, and I smiled. A couple of months later, Mom and Dad were talking about Karen Garrow during dinner. She's taking a sabbatical in Italy as soon as she gets out of the hospital, Mom said. She wants to work on her next book.
Hospital? I said, startled. Why is she in the hospital? Is she sick?
They exchanged a glance, one of their quick, silent conversations. Dad cleared his throat. Meadow and Sunny were paying attention, too. Our parents didn't lie to us, not if they could help it. But that didn't mean they always told the truth.
Karen's ex-husband is not a very nice man, Dad said.
And Mom said, For all that she's a genius about everything else, she can be really stupid about men. It was an uncharacteristically nasty judgment from my mother, but she got that way sometimes when she was upset. I thought about those fine scars on Karen's neck, faded and hidden beneath the rich curtain of hair. But Dad changed the subject before I could ask what had happened. Chapter 16. The stars blinked out. I woke up, and everything hurt. I was lying on my side on a hard floor. I could still taste Mr. Willow's concoction at the back of my throat. Sour bile mixed with the metallic taint of blood. I had no idea how long I had been gone. My limbs burned as the feeling came back. I could make my heart beat again, but erratically. One by one, I identified my injuries. My jaw, my knee, the rib Lyle had snapped. They all ached, but the pain was muted. I could open my mouth, move my toes, inhale and exhale. There was a hot, tight burn in the slashes on my side, but the cuts on my neck and face seemed to have healed. My head felt like somebody had hit me with a hammer. I opened my eyes. The room was dim, but not completely dark. Faint light flickered behind me. It took some effort, but I managed to sit up and look around. I was in a closed room. A trio of fat candles sat in the center of the floor. There was no furniture except a flat, stained mattress slumped against the wall. There were two windows, both boarded up on the inside. I couldn't tell if it was day or night. The walls, the floor, the ceiling, the crown molding and closed door, the plywood over the windows, it was all painted red. When I looked straight at it, the paint was a dull, dirty reddish-brown, sloppy and uneven. The wallpaper underneath showed through in spots, a pattern of flowers and birds and delicate trees. But when I glanced to the side, the walls almost seemed to glisten in the unsteady candlelight, slick and shimmering as though streaks of paint were still wet. And in those sidelong glances, it was all red, a deep and suffocating red wrapped all around me. Thump! I wasn't alone. There was a woman sitting in the far corner of the room. She lifted her bare feet. They were bound together, and brought them down again. Thump! There was a wide strip of duct tape over her mouth, and her hands were behind her back. Thump! She tossed her head impatiently, a motion that reminded me of a skittish horse. Okay, I said. Just a second. I wasn't sure I could stand. So I crawled. Caked mud and blood flaked from my clothes and skin. I was filthy, completely disgusting from head to toe, and the effort of creeping across that eerie red room made my head spin. When I got too close to the candles, I felt a shivery chill, so I kept my distance. I paused to let the nausea subside, then crawled the last few feet to the woman. This is going to hurt, I said. She rolled her eyes. I ripped the duct tape from her mouth and she exhaled loudly. My hands, she said. She slid away from the wall and twisted around. I tore the tape from around her wrists. She balled it up, tossed it away, and began peeling the tape from her ankles. You're awake.
I guess so, I said.
You were out for a long time.
How long?
And when I say out, I mean you weren't breathing.
Heavy sleeper, I said. How long?
How should I know? It's been at least a day since they dumped you here.
I rubbed at the grime on my face. It hurt to talk. Hurt to sit up. Hurt to move. My tongue was still sore from the punctures of Lyle's claws.
You look like shit,
the woman said.
Thanks, I feel awesome.
Through the torn dress, I could feel the four hot, swollen slashes on my side, scabbed over but not yet stitched back together. Maybe they were too deep to heal by themselves, or maybe Lyle had venom in his claws. I tried to remember the colorful diagrams I had learned in 10th grade anatomy class. Was my liver on that side? My appendix? I couldn't remember. We had only ever looked at pictures of human bodies. The only real corpses we cut up were euthanized cats. Mr. Beautiful. That's what Melanie and I had named ours, because he was the ugliest cat we had ever seen. Melanie did most of the dissecting. She wanted to be a doctor someday, and cutting up Mr. Beautiful was the most fun she ever had in school. I stopped bothering my wounds and rubbed my hands over my face, winced through the pins and needles. The room was small and square. No closet. The door was closed. The candles smelled like vanilla, cloyingly sweet, but it wasn't enough to hide the stink. Bleach, and beneath that, unwashed bodies and sweat, piss and shit. The faint metal stench of blood. Everything was red. So dull and dirty and red. The woman was staring at me. "Where are we?" I asked. "Are we still in the farmhouse?" "What farmhouse?" "At the church, in Nebraska. Mr. Willow's church. Isn't that where we are?" "Oh, is that how they got you?" The woman laughed. It wasn't a friendly sound. "That's perfect. Did they tell you they wanted to save your immortal soul and take away everything that makes you evil?" "Something like that." "And you walked right into it." Walk right into it was exactly what I had done. I hadn't seen the danger until it was too late. "I have no idea where we are," the woman admitted. "We're in a house, but I don't know where. It might be Nebraska. We could be on the freaking moon, for all I know. I was in Colorado when they grabbed me. This guy bought me a drink."
She made a face and touched her jaw with one slender hand. There was a fading bruise on her left side.
"Tasted like shit. Never trust a frat boy in a Steelers jersey who wants to buy you a drink. I can't figure out what you are."
"What?"
"You. What are you? I'm usually good at this, but I can't figure you out at all. You're breathing now."
She unfolded her legs and stood, walked closer and sat down again on the other side of the candles. She was strikingly beautiful. So beautiful I felt guilty for my initial impression of horsiness. She had auburn hair cut in a severe page boy, pale skin, and wide golden eyes, and her limbs were long and ballet elegant. I guessed she was in her 30s, but I wouldn't have bet on it. She wasn't a killer. There were no shadows of guilt clinging to her.
"Come on, share," she said. "I'll show you mine if you show me yours." "What are you?"
"Schrödinger's cat. Nice to meet you."
She snorted, unimpressed. "It's not like it will matter by the time they're done with us."
"What's your name?
Will you tell me that? Or do I have to keep thinking of you as smelly girl?"
"Breezy," I said. I could have lied again, but it didn't seem to matter anymore.
"Seriously?"
"Seriously."
"Were your parents hippies or something?"
"My parents had named me Breezy because they were young and sleep-deprived and overly fond of marijuana when they found themselves in possession of a newborn neither of them had planned for. They were graduate students, Dad in biochemistry at MIT and Mom in neuroscience at Harvard, and they wrote their theses in a one-bedroom Somerville apartment while a fat, red baby squalled in the crib. As an infant, I looked like a lumpy red potato with a smear of black slime mold for hair. It's not like they were planning on getting any sleep anyway, Mom liked to say. So after they got their PhDs, they decided they might as well get married and make more screaming, red-faced, half-Chinese, half-Irish babies. Two more, also girls, Meadow and Sunny, because Mom and Dad never got over the embarrassing names phase of parenthood. We all grew up to be short and black-haired and looked mostly Chinese except for our freckles, which came from Mom's side of the family. The woman's question put a tight, cold knot in my stomach. I didn't want to think about Mom and Dad and my sisters. "Yes," I said. I half-heartedly considered a new version of the patchwork girl. My sixth-grade locker neighbor, Free Farmer, had wannabe hippie parents. Never mind that they had been born in the late 70s themselves. And she had rebelled by going full goth as soon as she was old enough to pick out her own clothes. But that all felt like too much effort for the sake of a lie. So I only said, "It could have been worse. It could have been Zen or Soulfire or something. I can't even imagine what kind of names they would have stuck on my siblings if I had any." The woman laughed. "Hey, I'm not judging. You can call me Rain." "Great. Together we can be the weather report." My leg didn't ache quite as much anymore. So I stood up, paused to get my balance, and walked to the door.
It's locked, Rain said. And it's...
I didn't think it would be as simple as opening the door and walking out, but I wasn't expecting what happened. I reached for the knob, and there was a cool, solid pressure on my skin. Before I could react, the cold turned to heat. Searing heat, like putting my hand on an electric stove coil. And I was overcome with a dizziness so intense my vision darkened. I stumbled away from the door, gagging and gasping.
That, said Rain. It's locked.
Just for us. There was no burn on my hand, but I could still feel it. Rain leaned back on her elbows and watched me make my way around the room. The same thing happened when I tried to touch any of the walls and when I got too near the candles. I couldn't even get close enough to pry around the plywood over the windows. When I gave up, Rain said,
"They wouldn't be very good at catching monsters if they didn't know how to monster-proof a room."
Monsters. There it was. A word I had been deliberately not thinking for 2 weeks. It's... I didn't want to say it out loud. How? She raised an eyebrow.
Magic. How else?
And there was the other one. Magic.
Like in Harry Potter?
I said stupidly.
Rain laughed. Yes, exactly like that.
Gosh, if only we had our unicorn hair wands, we could get Professor McGonagall to help. I tried to glare at her, but my heart wasn't in it. I'm kind of new at this. I don't know how it works.
See the walls? That's how it works.
I picked at the edge of a ruddy brown floorboard. I had no trouble touching the floor. What is it?
Well, it's not paint, and it's not ketchup.
I shuddered and wiped my hand on my dress. I didn't want to believe her, but magical force fields made of blood weren't much of a stretch after everything else that had happened.
But who does this? I asked. How do they know how to do it? How does it even work?
You really are new at this, aren't you?
Yes, very.
That's kind of interesting, actually. Most of us are born into it.
Born into what? What are you talking about?
Sit down, Rain said. You're making me dizzy. Why don't you start by telling me what you know, and I'll tell you how you've got everything wrong. I sat across from her and tried to find a position that didn't make every part of my body ache.
I barely knew where to begin. Since I had woken up, come back, I had been assuming I was the only one.
I had tried to figure out what I was by looking on the internet, naturally. But the internet insisted giant 4-foot-tall frogs stalked unwary travelers in the wilds of Ohio.
I couldn't believe any of it. Then there was Violet, telling me there were other things like me in the world. Not just a few. Not rare. But everywhere. Common enough that people went looking for them at truck stops. Common enough that Mr. Willow had built an entire church around hunting them down.
Us. Hunting us down.
I wasn't on the outside of this, looking in at the monsters and marveling at their bad luck. I was in the cage. Monsters and magic. It was a little late for me to be having a this-can't-possibly-be-happening freak-out, but I felt one coming on anyway. I needed to stay calm. Take the logical approach. I had spent my entire life before I died knowing exactly what I wanted to do and exactly how I was going to do it. And now all I could think was that I really wished I had my notebook so I could add to my real, not real list. That might make me feel better. I was a little bit disgusted with myself. But I did have questions.
Some people aren't human, I said. Right?
Rain snorted.
Gosh, really? Maybe some of them are in this very room.
And some people can do magic.
Sometimes they're even the same people.
Only sometimes?
Sure, not always, she said.
She was delighted by my ignorance and not bothering to hide it.
Mostly it's humans who do magic.
Like wizards?
That earned a deep, throaty laugh.
They don't call themselves wizards.
What do they call themselves?
Magicians, mostly. Sometimes the old ladies or Wiccan chicks call themselves witches. There was this dude in Palm Springs who called himself the Grand Majestic Sorcerer of the Imperial Valley. But he was a douche and I think somebody ate him. The rest are just magicians.
And no, she said, before I could ask. I don't mean the top hat and rabbit on a stage in Vegas kind of magician.
Too late. I was already imagining the top hat and rabbit variety.
So the people who put us in here, they're magicians?
At least one of them is,
Rain said.
She looked around the red room and shrugged.
A pretty good one, too. This is some serious shit. Is the other one secure?
Mr. Willow had asked over the phone, like he was talking about a rabid animal. I wondered if it was impolite to ask Rain what she was, after I had refused to answer that same question from her. I decided I probably ought to work up to it. Instead, I asked, How long have you been here?
I don't know. Maybe a week.
Alone? Rain was silent for a long moment, and when she spoke again, her voice was lower. Slower.
Not at first. There was somebody else when they brought me here. A woman.
In the candlelight, I saw, for just a second, a shape beside Rain. A weeping woman with blood on her clothes, holding her face in her hands. I flinched, which only made the throbbing pain in my side worse. I was only imagining it. There was nobody else in the room. What happened to her?
They took her away.
I saw that, too. The woman screaming, clawing at the floor, kicking as men without faces dragged her through the door. Her screams were so clear I would have sworn they were real. They had the shape of names torn from her throat, of pleas that were so far beyond desperation they were barely even words anymore. I felt her fear as if it were my own, racing blood and pounding heart and cold sweat. The red walls pressed all around, closer and closer, and the woman's hands caught, claw-like, on the doorframe, and she was gone. I blinked. The walls retreated, and the room faded to dull brown.
You mean Mr. Willow? He took her away?
Rain raised a single, delicate eyebrow. Her cheekbones were sharp in the candlelight. I tried not to stare.
You met the big man, did you?
Her voice was normal again.
Not many people get to do that. Not me. I got his minions.
Rain jerked her thumb toward the closed door.
That asshole out there. He's our prison guard.
I met Mr. Willow, I said. I didn't know he was the big man of anything.
Is he as scary as they say?
I'm picturing the mutant offspring of Charles Manson and Ted Bundy. He looks like a middle-aged Mormon missionary, I said, and Rain laughed. I didn't realize he was famous.
Everybody knows about Willow, Rain said,
but then she amended.
All the monsters in Colorado, anyway. He's been around forever, but small scale. Family deal. It usually is, you know. Grandpa discovers there are monsters among us back in the day and spends his life training up all his gap-tooth redneck spawn to hunt them down. They don't usually share it around.
Nobody's that good at keeping secrets, I protested, even though I knew she had to be right. If I was taking the logical approach, I had to accept that. Monsters were real, because I was one. Most people had no idea they existed, because I never had before.
Two true things.
It was an unsettling realization, to say the least, that those two truths were the new center of my world. Rain shrugged.
Who would believe them? It's easier to keep a secret if anybody who tells the truth is considered delusional. That's the way it was with Willow's dad. He was this paranoid backwoods militia guy, you know the type,
and everybody knew he was batshit. His group fell apart after something bad went down. Some members of his congregation died. Nobody really knows what happened. But he's been gone for years, and nobody knew his son was carrying on Daddy's mission until a few years ago.
She smiled, quick and predatory. We ran them out. That was a fun night.
Violet had said that they moved their congregation from Colorado to Nebraska. I hadn't thought to ask why. I hadn't suspected the reason could be that people objected to being grabbed off the streets and magically imprisoned in blood-stained rooms.
But you said they got you in Colorado anyway.
I guess the asshole decided he didn't want to stay run out.
Rain stretched her legs before her and yawned.
A lot of people are going to be really pissed when they find out he's hunting in Boulder again. It's worse with humans like him, you know? The ones who just hate us because their second cousin's great-grandmother's best friend saw a scary monster in the woods are one thing. Who cares what they think? But people like Willow, they think they're doing it for our own good. He's even got people like us working for him.
Yeah, I met some of them. I still didn't know if Violet had been expecting me to stay, or hoping I would get away. And Lyle, I had a pretty good idea that Lyle wasn't exactly cooperating willingly. But I didn't know what hold Mr. Willow had over him and his sister. I still hurt too much from the damage Lyle had done to me to care all that much. What do they do to people? I asked. Rain started to answer, but I added quickly, I mean the ones they don't kill. Is it some kind of a magic ritual or something?
Magic ritual?
Rain laughed again. It was a big laugh, bold and unashamed, and I was really starting to dislike it.
God, you're adorable.
Yes, Breezy, it's a magic ritual.
No idea what it is, though. I've only ever met one guy who survived it, and he says he can't remember. Of course, that could be all the mind-altering drugs he took to get over the trauma.
Not what it is, I thought. She had that wrong.
Who?
Mr. Willow and Violet had both been absolutely clear on that point. There was a who involved. A woman they called Mother, who liked to be given gifts of bound and bleeding monsters wrapped up with a bow.
Rain went on. What I don't get.
She stopped, cocked her head to one side. There were footsteps outside the room and a man's murmuring voice. Rain crept over to the door. There was no shimmer of air when she leaned close, no sparks of light. I didn't know what I was expecting. A little more flash. Magic was supposed to be flashy. The man said,
It's fine. It's strong enough, I swear. Yeah, I can hear both of them. Even though, yes, I won't. Nothing's going to...
A pause.
Fine. Whatever.
His voice grew quieter, and his footsteps retreated. Rain sat down again. Who is that? I asked.
He's our prison guard.
Is he human?
Far as I know.
Is he alone?
For now, yeah, but he'll have help when it's time to take us away.
Rain leaned back on her hands and gave me a narrow look. Don't even think about it. Even if he opens the door, we won't be able to get out. It's stupid to try anything while we're stuck in here, so don't. Does it work? I asked.
Does what work?
Whatever they do to people. I already regretted asking, but it was too late to take it back. What they do when they say they can help. Does it work? You said you knew somebody who did it.
She looked at me for a long time before answering. If you wanted to find out that bad, you should have just gone with them.
They were a little evangelical for my tastes. But she was still staring at me.
Whatever you're thinking, you need to get over it, she said. We are what we are. Most of us are fine with it. There's no point in hating something that's natural. What you're asking, that's like asking a human if they can be a chimpanzee instead. Stop thinking about it. It's only the humans who think we need to be fixed.
There was a nasty twist on the word fixed. My instinctive thought, but I am human. I bit my lip to keep the words from escaping. I felt a pinch in my gut, a queasy uncertainty that was more emotion than rational thought. When I let myself think of how it might go, if Mr. Willow's mother could do what he said she could do, the possibility was so tantalizing it made my breath catch. I could get rid of these shadows, this body, this aimless flight from everything familiar. I could go home. But right on its heels came the rest of it. Esme drooling on her towel, the knitting woman by the window, the children who played without joy, without sound. Violet touching my face and telling me to run. Lyle's apology rasping in my ear. I needed my notebook. I needed my real, not real list. I needed my observations and hypotheses. I didn't know who to believe. I didn't know what to think. Rain didn't know what I had done. Didn't know I had a body count just 2 weeks into my new life as a monster. I wondered how she would react if she knew. If she would be less amused, more wary. Or if stories like mine were common in her world. Mr. Willow didn't know what I had done either. And he already thought I was an evil thing that needed to be destroyed. The walls, the floor, the ceiling, all smeared in those shifting, changeable shades of red and brown. I didn't trust the judgment of anybody who could put people in a room like this. It was better to think of the walls that way. Red, not blood-stained. Blood-stained didn't even do them justice. Blood-soaked. Blood-drenched. I didn't know how much blood that would take, or why it could keep us in. I doubted blood by the pint from the local butcher shop and a fancy textured roller from Home Depot were how they went about making a room like this. I had no idea what time it was. There was no light visible through the boarded-up windows. I didn't think much of Rain's sit-and-wait plan, but I didn't have any better ideas. I couldn't learn anything new as long as we were stuck in here. I couldn't lean against any of the walls without making myself sick, and there was no way I was going near the stained mattress. So I lay flat on my back to ease the pain in my side and entertained a lot of creatively nasty thoughts about Lyle and his claws. Lyle, Lyle, venomous humanoid crocodile. Not for the first time. I missed my stars. It was cold in the darkness. Cold and lonely and empty, and I had been dead. But it was quiet and peaceful. Nobody had ever tried to strangle me or drug me or rip me apart with their claws when I was floating in the stars. Chapter 17. There were footsteps in the hallway again. I sat up, and Rain rose to her feet. A key rattled and the door opened. I was expecting somebody like Mr. Willow, with his have-you-accepted-Jesus-as-your-savior hair and warm smile. But the man in the doorway looked like he had reached the age of 30 without realizing he wasn't a frat boy anymore. No Steelers jersey, but he had blonde hair and gelled spikes, a t-shirt advertising a craft beer, baggy cargo shorts, and a tattoo of a sunburst on his right calf. He also had a shotgun. He raised it to his shoulder and pointed it at Rain.
Don't say anything.
Why not? Don't you want to chat?
Shut up, the man said. Come over here.
Rain smiled. Come and get me.
I don't have time for this,
he said. He didn't come through the door. Oh, are we interrupting your busy day? Rain said. We're so sorry about that.
Shut the hell up!
Holding the gun with one hand, the man reached into his pocket with the other and brought out a stiff plastic zip tie.
Don't say anything. Put this on. Both hands.
He threw the tie at Rain. It dropped to the floor. She nudged it with her bare toe. Seriously? She glanced at me. She was grinning.
Can you believe this guy? He thinks he's in a cop movie.
Wrong genre, I said. My mouth was dry. I wasn't happy she had reminded the man of my presence. I tensed when he turned the gun in my direction.
You get back, he said.
I slid along the floor until I felt the magical wall at my back. The man turned his attention and the gun back to Rain.
Put those on and get over here. Don't talk. Don't say one word.
Where's your backup?
Rain said, and her voice was changing again, slowing down, deeper, almost sultry, like she was flirting with him. But there was nothing flirtatious about the look in her eyes.
Aren't you supposed to wait for help before you let the animals out of their cage?
I could see it. The cage in the old-fashioned wallpaper beneath the blood. Vines and leaves turning to iron.
Shut up! Either you come with me now, or you stay in there!
He didn't say permanently, but only because he didn't have the appropriate sense of drama. He was shaking, nervous and scared. There was sweat trickling down the side of his face.
I think you should come in here, Rain said.
Stop wasting my time! Stop talking!
I really think you should come in here. We have something to talk about.
He really should come in here. It was warm and red and so much better than out there. I shook myself. I didn't want him in the room. I wanted him to leave. The man looked just as uneasy as I felt. But when Rain said it a third time,
Come in, Brian. Let's talk about why I'm here.
He stepped through the doorway. As soon as he was inside the room, I felt it. He was speaking to Rain, telling her to shut up again.
Shut up, shut up, shut up!
But I couldn't focus on the words. With the others, the man at my grave and Duncan Palmer in his blue Corolla, the war vets in McDonald's, the people I passed on the street. It felt like clinging vines, a tangle of shadows invisible but still somehow dark, dirty, gray banners trailing behind them, a constant reminder of what they had done. This man was nothing like that. This man was a flood of thick, black oil. His stupid hair, his angry expression, all of it vanished in the overpowering roar of the people he had killed. He had killed so many people, that's all there was to him. Those dark tentacles swirling like a living thing, grasping and strangling, reaching from his mouth, from his eyes, tangled about his arms and legs like ropes, dragging him along as though they were alive and he was only their puppet. I couldn't imagine how somebody so young could have taken so many lives. I heard twin shouts, the man and Rain, but I paid no attention. A strangled cry ripped from my throat. I flung myself at the man and tackled him around the waist. He was bigger than me, a full foot taller, but I caught him by surprise. He tripped backward, went down on his ass. He swung the shotgun around, struck the side of my head hard enough to make white spots erupt in front of my eyes. He was shouting. Threats. Curses. I couldn't understand him. I didn't care. I couldn't hear anything except the furious roar and the jackhammering of my own heart. The man rocked up on his back and kicked me, planting the sole of one shoe on the unhealed slashes from Lyle's claws. I screamed and doubled over, rolled to the side as he fired the gun. My ears rang, and for several seconds I couldn't hear anything at all. Then I heard the second shot, also wide, that time because Rain had kicked him in the face as he was climbing to his feet. She was shouting too, but her voice was so faint she could have been miles away. All I could hear was the ringing. The pain in my side was overpowering, sickening. And I was distantly aware of another, smaller pain. A new one. Sharp points of heat in my shoulder and neck. The man got his feet under him and lunged toward me, swinging the shotgun like a bat. I ducked and grabbed his arm with both hands, digging my fingernails into his skin. He beat at my back with the gun, but I held on, and I pulled. It had been so easy with the man in the car, a clean break like a bone snapping. This wasn't easy. This was too much. So many deaths. And he carried all of them, dragged them in a thick black web. I tried, but it was like falling face first into a thicket of thorns. The pain was overwhelming. I let go. The man dropped like a marionette whose strings had been cut. The shotgun clattered to the floor. Somebody was screaming, screaming without words, impossibly loud inside my head. I collapsed. I trembled on the floor for a long time, eyes squeezed shut, unable to move. The man's memories swallowed me in a black tsunami, his hand tight around pale wrists and ankles. Men, women, small wrists, small ankles, children, some in the red room, some in a dark tunnel, an endless, hungry throat. The fingers of his victims scrabbled on hard rock, clawed until they bled. The sweet scent of pine trees and the stench of blood. Gritty sand beneath my toes. The crunch of small white bones. The startling clang of a metal door slamming. And another, and another, and laughter down a long, long tunnel. There were too many of them, all jumbled together and confused. I couldn't separate them because he couldn't separate them anymore. The pleas and screams faded. It felt like hours, but only moments passed. The world beyond his memories began to penetrate.
Holy shit! What did you do?
Rain was shouting, her voice so loud it was a drumbeat inside my skull. I tried to tell her that I didn't know, but the words came out as a pained gasp.
That was awesome! What the hell are you?
I couldn't speak. I opened my eyes, got my hands under me, and pushed myself up. Rain was standing on the other side of the room, staring at me with her eyes wide, her mouth open.
Holy shit, girl! Why aren't you dead? He shot you!
I don't know. He missed. I don't know. Both blasts from the shotgun had gone wide, but I was bleeding sluggishly from pellet bites in my arm and the side of my neck. The wall behind me was pockmarked, pale wood showing through chips in the blood. Already the pain was burrowing away. I couldn't ignore it, but I could bear it. I had spent the first 17 years of my life never suffering anything worse than a sprained ankle and monthly cramps. But I was getting used to hurting all the time. I had never thought being dead would hurt so much more than being alive. I breathed until I was steady, then inched across the floor toward the man.
"What are you doing?" Rain said. "Stop it! You're messed up! Relax! What are you doing?"
When I looked up at her, the shock on her face slowly gave way to a wide grin. I had attacked a man in a blind animal rage, and she didn't know why, but it didn't frighten her. It delighted her. I felt shamed and sick to my stomach. I couldn't look at Rain anymore, so I studied the man on the floor.
"How did you do that?" she asked.
"He's not dead," I said. I needed her to know that. "He's not dead, just unconscious." Even as I said it, I knew it wasn't strictly true. I hadn't knocked him out with a blow to the head. This was different. His blue eyes were open, and he was breathing. I pressed my fingers to his neck. His heart was beating. There were scratches in his arm where I had dug in my fingernails. I looked at my hands, but I was covered.